ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Imagine small town Australia in the early 20th century, a simpler time, maybe a tougher time, but a time of sponge cakes, of oat and golden syrup biscuits, of steam puddings and Sunday roasts. Food is a common social vocabulary. Food is a thread of unity and connection. Set that down in black and white. Gather all those loose slips of butter-stained paper, the recipes that make a house a home. Put it all together and what do you get? 20 recipes for passion fruit sponge. And a community cookbook. A unique snapshot of a particular community at a particular moment in time.
Some of the really fascinating key attributes of the recipes when you start looking and flicking through these old cookbooks, they just used what they had and they used everything that they had. Nothing was wasted.
And sometimes that snapshot reveals more than just the preferences and produce of a community.
These mothers couldn't save their own children, but they produced this book that would help fundraise a memorial in honour of them and other members of their family that they'd lost during war.
And there's something generous about ordinary people sharing tried and tested recipes with a stranger. Although sometimes those recipes demonstrate the value of a professional test kitchen and a good editor.
Sugar, eggs and flour can be combined to make an incredibly diverse number of things. If the title of the recipe doesn't give you a clue as to what it is, looking at the ingredient list isn't always enough to tell you.
I'm Jonathan Green and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science and history collide. This week, cooking community, a recipe for social connection.
I call them books with heart. They come out of a desire to raise money and support the community and share knowledge, and there's something about these books that's different to other cookbooks that most of us might buy today.
Liz Harfel is author of Tried, Tested and True, Treasured Recipes and Untold Stories from Australia's Community Cookbooks. So, this idea of the community cookbook, do we know when and where it began?
Well, we think we do. The first known community cookbook came out of America during the Civil War in the 1860s, and it raised money for the care of Union soldiers from the North. It was called a poetical cookbook, which is a very interesting title.
The poetical may have changed over time, but it became quite an effective and popular means of fundraising.
It certainly did. It quite quickly spread to Canada and then to Australia. We think in the 1890s, the first known community cookbook was in Queensland. It's actually a competition between two, and floods destroyed the records for one from the little community of Clermont in the central Queensland, and the other was a very well-known book put out by the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union and published for many decades. And then it just took off like wildfire.
We would have to have mentioned at some point in this conversation that PWMU cookbook, because that is a famous tome.
Well, it is. The Queensland version, its success prompted the publisher to write to the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union in Victoria, who took up the challenge and put out a cookbook in 1904, and it is still in print. It is the longest continuously published cookbook in Australia and maybe the world. It's an extraordinary book that's lived through many generations and reiterations.
Which it speaks to the popularity of the form. We know that in modern publishing that cookbooks are the biggest non-fiction sellers in the world. But here's an example of how that is a long-standing interest.
Yes, and I think the key here is that it's tied to community and a sense of place, if not a sense of time. It sort of transcends that. But they have a kind of organic life because people keep adding to them and they feel free to write notes in them and pin other recipes into them and build on them. So I think that's all contributed to them going way beyond their original publishing date.
At the heart of all of them, there's a kitchen table with a couple of people thinking, this is a good idea. and starting to assemble that network of food ideas and enthusiasms.
Yes, exactly. In many cases, they've been put together by women who have sat back and looked at the skills they have, the skills that they trust and what they can leverage for a good cause. And for a long time, they were pretty much sort of stuck to the house and the kitchen. So writing a book that guided women in cooking and caring for their families was something they felt confident to do. And often, yeah, they were put together by small committees. Sometimes they were put together by one woman who had a lifetime of recipes that she decided to compile because her local church needed money or the Society for the Blind or something like that.
This seems especially a thing, the community cookbook of the late 19th and early 20th century. Was that its heyday?
I actually think it went well beyond that. I, when I was researching Tried, Tested and True, I looked at about 1,000 community cookbooks.
Is that all?
And I barely scratched the surface, to be honest. And they are still coming out in huge numbers because, of course, today there was a huge amount of them came out in the 60s and 70s when all of a sudden people had access to Rodeo and Gestetner machines and they could produce their own versions very cheaply at the school office and, you know, volunteers would walk around a table picking up pages and then stapling them together. So there was a lot of community cookbooks that came out of that period and they just kept going. And, of course, now there's online and digital printing services, so they're still coming out in quite significant numbers, but they're much glossier and more professional looking than the ones that you would have found, you know, in previous decades. And I think they're still seen as a very viable way to raise money for a cause.
Of course, the period we're talking about, up until the middle of the 20th century, the cookbook culture, the commercial published cookbook culture, has changed radically. They tended in that early 20th century period to be manuals of domestic instruction. They were fairly plain affairs. The things that we would recognise as cookbooks today are a reasonably recent invention.
Yeah, that's true. So the whole style of writing the recipe has changed, let alone how it's packaged. So the early books, no photographs, of course, just plain text presented in the plainest way. The early cookbooks didn't even have fancy covers. They basically said in very clear lettering the title and the purpose of the book and what you would find in it. It was very matter of fact. And the early recipes were written more like stories with the ingredients woven into the method. Of course, the unifying feature was often that the donor's name was underneath. And that really didn't change very much at all until probably during the First World War, they started to develop much fancier covers that were about championing the war effort, images of the flags and men in uniform and that would capture people's eyes.
Liz Harfel, author of Tried, Tested and True. Well, one such World War I-era community cookbook was the Barossa Cookery Book, recipes donated by the people of the Barossa Valley. It was released in 1917 to raise money for the South Australian Soldiers Fund, and it stayed in print, with profits later contributing to the Tanunda Soldiers Memorial Hall. But putting this cookbook together was not a straightforward task. The cultural heritage of some contributors raised uncomfortable questions for the community itself.
It was a predominantly German community, cooking predominantly German recipes in a time when we were at war with Germany. So there's lots of German names in the book, as you would expect, but no German recipes. I'm Sherilee Menz, and I'm one half of those Barossa girls.
And I'm Marika Ashmore, and I'm the other half of those Barossa girls.
And together for the last 4 or 5 years, we've been working on a project called Rolling Up Their Sleeves, which is a remake of Barossa's traditional cookbook called The Barossa Cookery Book. Certainly in a lot of the research that we've done in the last couple of years, researching and tracing the women and their life stories, lots of their sons changed their names when they enlisted. So if you had a particularly German surname, then, you know, you changed its spelling or you changed it entirely when you enlisted so that you didn't appear too German.
So it was an area, even back then, of wine production, of orchards, of a really intense rural scene.
Absolutely. So it was predominantly sort of, you know, in 1917 was largely self-sufficient farming. So, you know, small blocks of land, they had to milk the cow and raise the pig and feed the chooks and collect the eggs and make the butter. There was some grape growing, of course, but it was predominantly fruit growing and mixed farming, and grapes was just one of the things.
So it's a place of great produce, and I guess here we have then the genesis of a cookery book is the things from those farms.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the really fascinating key attributes of the recipes when you start looking and flicking through these old cookbooks generally, not just this one, they just used what they had and they used everything that they had, that nothing was wasted.
We get preserves, of course. We get all those techniques of making things stretch out a little bit longer.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other fascinating things too is that, of course, we're talking about a largely German community, predominantly Lutheran, and one of the foundation principles of the Lutheran faith is that food is a gift from God, so you use all of it. You don't waste any of it. So, you know, every last piece of the pig and every last manky apricot, all of it is utilised and honoured, and so you certainly see all of that kind of coming through in the recipes.
The project of discovery here, how did you two become interested in this book and this community activity?
Well, look, we'd always been a little bit fascinated by the Barossa Cookery Book. It's such a quaint, cute book. It's been in constant print since 1917. It's up to edition 35 or 36 now. And the proceeds from the book still go back to maintaining the community and the Tanunda Soldiers Memorial Hall. And that kind of that story of resonance just was really, really beautiful. But it wasn't until we came across, there was a PhD thesis written by one of our local historians. It wasn't until we came across her PhD thesis that we kind of really started to understand how to interpret all of the other information that was encoded into the recipes. Because up until that point, to us, it was just a recipe book. And then once we'd read this PhD thesis and started to understand how you could peel back the layers and understand the depth of, you know, all the social construct of those recipes as well, that was when it became even more fascinating.
Marika, tell us more about those layers, what they revealed.
When you first pick it up, it really, you think it's just a cookbook, but there are it really speaks very much of, I guess, two separate times, because originally it was that war fundraiser in 1917, but it was reworked into a new edition in 1932. So we've got war years and we've got the beginning of the Depression. So it speaks of what the food was like there, that frugality and that seasonality. There's also an underlying war current. You know, these women who contributed recipes were grieving, I guess, in a way, for their sons and brothers. And it's sort of, I guess, a bit of a love letter to those children, in that these mothers couldn't save their own children, but they produced this book that would help fundraise a memorial in honour of them and other members of their family that they'd lost during war. And then there's that whole German element that we had talked about, lots of German names and no German recipes. So it was in a way, also a flag-waving exercise for these German families to show that their allegiance was with the empire and not Germany.
There is a wonderful sort of mental image there of a woman saddened at her own loss, but presenting this food to a broader community is a part of feeding that community, of giving that love to these other strange people.
Absolutely, yes. In our research, it came back again and again, these stories of loss, but still women contributing to their community, even when they must have been enduring a very private pain.
What do we know about the way in which the book was originally compiled? What was the process of gathering these recipes?
So there's kind of two distinct groups of women. So there's the women who compiled the cookbook, who put it together, and they were a small group largely of Anglican women. And then there were the women who contributed recipes from much more broadly across the Barossa. And that's where we start to see a lot of the Lutheran names and a lot of the traditional German recipes being included. However, the names were being changed on the recipes. So they were traditional German recipes but being given a different name. So certainly a lot of the women who were compiling the cookbook, the women from in the town of Tanunda, you know, their recipes are the frothy layered sponge cakes and the, you know, the extravagant trifles and the, you know, the rich meat dishes. Whereas the women on the farms are using much more frugal recipes that, funnily enough, are a lot less reliant on things like eggs and butter, even though you would assume that being on a self-sufficient farm, you would have ample access to those ingredients, and they did. However, butter and eggs and walnuts, they were all cash money. You could sell all of that as a cash crop. So, you know, on a small self-sufficient farm, even though you had plenty of butter, you were cooking really frugally so that you could sell as much as you could.
Tell us about some of the women that you discovered.
Oh, look, women like Wanda Traeger, who, she was a devout Lutheran. She spoke German exclusively until she was married when she was about 18 or 19. She taught herself to speak English and to count and read English. Fascinating. And she made the most intricate lace work. Beautiful, beautiful work. But yes, one of our favourite recipes from Wanda is a ginger sponge, which is just an absolute show-stopping recipe. But yeah, you know, other fascinating stories of women like Faye Smith, whose son was killed missing in action 8 months before the book was published. So, you know, she'd lost her own son, but here she is contributing to the cookbook. And not only the cookbook, you know, she was a life member of the Red Cross, the League of Loyal Women, the Cheer Up Society. You know, she contributed so much of her own time and energy to the community, even after she'd lost her own son. Yeah, like, I mean, and all of the stories are fascinating in their own way.
The woman with the lost son, what did she contribute? What were her recipes?
She contributed three recipes. Her and her daughter contributed recipes. Faye put in an apple cake recipe, a ginger beer recipe, and there was one other, which I can't remember. Katie, her daughter, put in oatmeal biscuits. So like Anzac biscuits as a recipe didn't actually emerge until after World War I, but oatmeal biscuits were being made quite prolifically and regularly during World War I and being shipped overseas. So Katie's recipe is an oatmeal biscuit, which was one of the really early versions of an Anzac. You know, the recipes are very, very simple and they resonate quite broadly. Certainly in the years that followed when other community cookbooks started to get put together, you see the same recipes appearing with somebody else's name.
How do they taste, Marika, to the modern palate?
I think they taste pretty good. I make quite a lot of them quite regularly. But I guess especially you notice with the cakes, because nowadays I think we're used to cakes with lots of butter and lots of eggs, so a much moister kind of cake. A lot of the cakes that are in the book have less butter, so they tend to be a little bit drier, but no less delicious. I mean, they're really tasty. There's some savoury recipes as well for, you know, fish pie, scalloped fish, macaroni and cheese. Those kind of things are very quick and easy and still very tasty. And I guess in some way there is that little bit of nostalgia there too, because food can evoke such strong memories, and you make sometimes these recipes and you think, that transports me back to, you know, Friday night dinners when I was a child, or, you know, that's the biscuit that I used to get when I went to my grandma's house. So there's that beautiful nostalgia that comes along with those recipes too.
And that's the thing, I guess, to open that book, as you can, I can do it right now. Open the Barossa Cookery book and I will find the coconut tart here on page 53, and I could...
Yes, coconut spelt with an A.
Well, indeed, and I could make that and be connected to a woman of 1917, contributing that proudly to this combined community venture.
Absolutely. That was one of the really fun things about the project, was about sort of 3 or 4 years ago, we'd converted the recipes to metric and we wanted to test them. And there were too many recipes. We couldn't test them all ourselves. So I did a call out on our social media page, and we had a group of people, about 110 or 120 people from across Australia, put their hand up to help test these recipes. And that was a fantastic feeling, you know, sending those recipes out and knowing that, you know, Wanda or Amanda or Emma's or Faye's recipes were still being cooked in kitchens right across the country more than 100 years after they were contributed. You know, that was really powerful.
Sherilee Menz and Marika Ashmore. Under the name Those Barossa Girls, they've published Rolling Up Their Sleeves, the recipes and the women behind the Barossa Cookery Book. From ABC Radio National, you're listening to Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. Now, one can marvel at the generosity of these women, carefully writing down their favourite recipes, sharing them with their community, especially when it might mean losing their position as the sole provider of the community's best ginger beer or coconut tarts. Surely some must have wanted to keep their kitchen secrets to themselves.
Liz Harfel.
Yes. It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because this comes up a lot for me when I'm working with the cooks I do, and I've been recently working on my third book about prize-winning show cooks, and you would assume that they wouldn't share their recipes because that gives them the edge in the competition. But there's two things that happen. One is that they really want to share the knowledge and keep the traditions alive, including the recipes themselves. But the other thing is that they often don't know what they know, so they leave things out, and it's not intentional. There's been lots of accusations that, oh, Mrs. Smith, her sponge doesn't work. We know she's not telling us the real recipe, and it's most likely because she knows it so well, it's so instinctive that she isn't always aware of exactly what she's doing, and let alone sort of translating it to the page. She just assumes a certain level of knowledge. And that happened a lot with these early cookbooks because most of them didn't have an experienced editor who could help sort of transition that knowledge onto the page.
Least of all a test kitchen to go through
exactly
all the recipes.
Right. Correct.
That's the other thing, and you mentioned this in the book, the way in which, especially in that earlier period, there's an assumption of knowledge. The method of these recipes is fairly scant because, of course, you know how to do that.
It's sometimes almost completely non-existent. And sometimes if the title of the recipe doesn't give you a clue as to what it is, you actually don't know what you're making. So the books that came out in the 1920s and 30s in particular were very short on method.
What do these books have in common?
I think you can feel the intent of most of them. They have heart. And they're a really interesting window into what was being made in the communities of their day as well, because the recipes that are contributed more often than not, they will have been someone's favourite. So they all give you a sense of what people in that community at that time were making. Almost uniformly, the baking has held up really well, the baking and preserving. There are main courses that you look at and go, oh my goodness, what were they thinking? But the baking and preserving has held up well, and often they're the biggest sections of the book as well. And there is one particular book, which is still in print, put out, I think, in about the 1950s, the Conniver Hospital Auxiliary Cookbook, still being sold today. And when it came out, there were six names under the golden syrup dumpling recipe because six different cooks had all contributed that recipe. Now, that tells me in that period, in that community, that was a really popular dessert to make.
And who doesn't love golden syrup dumplings?
True.
As you look at books from around the country, what regional differences do you see? Or is there a style of Australian, particularly country cooking, which is fairly uniform regardless of climate, seasonality, of local ingredients?
That's such a good question. You can see the influence of what was grown locally, particularly in the periods where people worked with what they had in their backyard or they could buy in local orchards and things like that. So, you know, out of the Riverland, there were, you know, I've come across books with lots of things like marmalade recipes using the citrus. So there's definitely that reflection. And then you can see some cultural influences too. So there's some really interesting cookbooks out of station properties in WA and Northern Territory and places like that, where there was a certain period where there were a lot of stations who employed Chinese cooks. And there's anglicised versions of their recipes, you know, been contributed by the stations for books like, you know, there were a few books that raised money for organisations like the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
Can you give us an example of that?
I remember seeing one out of WA that I think had an anglicised version of chop suey.
Actually using chops.
Well, no, I think it was minced beef, but... But one of the key flavourings that was used by a lot of station cooks was Keane's curry powder. It was a staple of station pantries in large tins, and it would keep forever. And it was used for everything from making curries and anglicised versions of Chinese dishes to sprinkling it over a steak before it was grilled and cooked. So that's one of those kind of ingredients that you see pop up in places where it's hard to get hold of fresh produce, and maybe the meat might have been hanging in the meat house a little bit long. So it's a great, great way of sort of creating a simple dominant flavour.
But there's, in all of this, there's sort of a fundamental act of trust and faith, isn't there? And cooking someone's recipe, you are taking them at their word.
You are taking them at their word. Yes, you are. That's true. But there's also a sense of getting to know them through those recipes, which is actually what drew me to this topic in the first place, because my grandmother died before I was born, but I have her collection of cookbooks, and they are predominantly these community cookbooks, which she has added her own notes and layer of knowledge into, as did my bachelor uncle, who, after she died, he took custody of them. But in looking through those recipes, and especially the ones that there's five or six variations of, because obviously there's a bit of a search going on to try and find the best version. In my family, the two recipes that stood out for that was apricot jam and what we called a German cake. It was a yeast cake with hard crust of sugar on the top. I feel like I've got a sense of who my grandmother was through those books, and, you know, making the apricot jam recipe, and, you know, my father loved puddings and desserts, so there's quite a few of those in there, things like her jam roly-poly. It's my way of getting to know her in many ways.
We cook, we eat, from recipes new and handed down. And often, those are things we share, perhaps unknowingly. It feels a little old-fashioned, but in a good way, to put those shared threads between covers and reveal the little ties that bind us. For the last word, here's Sherrod Lee Menz.
Every community had a cookbook like the Barossa Cookery Book, and every community had women like these. One of the things that we really hope Rolling Up Their Sleeves does is encourages people to pull open the drawer in their kitchen that's got all the old recipe books in it and, you know, flick back through their own old community cookbooks and think about, well, what are the recipes in this book tell me about where I live and where I fit and how I belong and the women who perpetuated that.
Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every bite tells a story. Thanks to our guests, Liz Harfel and those Barossa girls, Sherrod Lee Menz and Marika Ashmore. You can hear us on ABC Radio National or any time on the ABC Listen app, and share us around. Think of us as a community cookbook. If you enjoy the program and are listening somewhere where you can leave a review, please do give us 5 stars. That'll help new listeners find us, and we would love to hear your thoughts about what we do. Drop us an email, everybite, all one word, at abc.net.au. Everybite at abc.net.au. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jurek and Rachel Bongiorno. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.